good a mate of mine was into crypto and all this stuff, and he would like sometimes like show me some shit, and I never really kind of got it. And then one day he was talking about Ethereum, and then I just thought it was like cryptocurrencies, like just these little tokens. And I was like, like I didn't really understand it. But one day I learned about smart contracts, and then that's when the light bulb went on. And I was like, oh, this is
Yeah,
pretty
same
cool.
thing happened to me.
Yeah, and I was like, this is
Yeah.
pretty cool. So I started looking more into it. Then I realized, oh, maybe I could become a dev in the space or something like this. Because at the time I was either doing something with AI or ML. But AI, like the applicability, it's like you're gonna be just translating customer needs into like automations, which is, in my opinion, not super sexy, you know. And ML has a lot of red tape. You need to like a PhD on that shit, and if you wanna do like a proper app or whatever, you need all this data. So it's not really practical unless you're willing to invest all your life and time in it. And that wasn't appealing to me. So I was like, yeah, I was just gonna become a dev or something. And started looking into Solidity, started to learn it, realized that security was a big part of it. Just started getting to it, started doing quarter minute contests, and fast forward, that's why I ended up here, if that makes sense.
I did ML at Amazon, and I sort of had the same realization where I was like, this is not as you think it's cool when you're doing it. Or out from the outside looking in, and then when you're actually doing the work, you're like, this is, it's actually relatively easy software engineering, right? The data is like usually stationary. You're just like, there's already like a bunch of big data frameworks that take care of a lot of the distributed complexity. And so you're just like using the framework to move data from like, this unstructured format to a more structured format. And then like, usually the training model's already figured out too. And so you're not, it's not like you're inventing new ways of doing learn machine learning or whatever, right? So you're just like using someone else's library, right? So at the end of the day, it's really the complexity is not. I mean, kind of the same thing could be said for smart contracts, right? It's like a lot of the complexity around consensus and stuff like that has already been sort of sorted out for you at the client level, and so you're the sort of mental model that you have to use when you're programming Solidity isn't really that complex, you know?
I think it's different though, because with ML, you need, first of all, you're working at a company, so you had like already had access to all the data and stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
And the problems you're solving is more like you're assembling different things together and just like spitting something out. So you're kind of like a aggregator of things, if that makes sense. But and even then, the impact is going to be very specific to whoever you're working for. It's going to be like very narrowly scoped, and it's something that you don't have any control over. Whereas smart contracts, anyone can deploy anything at any time. The barrier to entry, fortunately or unfortunately, is very low. And that's just kind of cool. Like when you deploy your smart con like deploying your first smart contract is always like a weird experience, because normally you don't get to fucking program money, and then you just deploy something and you feel like, dude, if people actually sign up to this, anyone can use this, and it's a real thing, and it's so relatively easy. So I feel
It's
like,
globally distributed like immediately, right? Which is not the case for most other software. I mean, I guess maybe web development is kind of that way as well. So it's similar to web development in that regard. But it's, yeah, money is the big difference.
like for me that had no experience and no network or anything, it was a perfect fit. I was like, I can just get into this. There's no red tape. And especially in the security kind of things, they didn't need my name. They didn't need where I live. They didn't need anything. All I had to do was find bugs. And for someone with no experience,
Yeah, I
no
hear.
network, anything, it was like, yes, just fucking sign me up, you know?
I hear this story a lot. I would say most people, this is sort of how they end up getting into cryptos for that reason, exactly that reason, where it's like, oh, cool, I don't have to like. Not only that, but like, even if you were a dev, if you wanted to go work at Fang, you got to go do all the LeetCode crap, right? And that obviously annoys a lot of people as well, right? Whereas like Web3 ethos is very much like, just go do the work. Like if you can do the work, you're going to get paid. Simple as that, you know? There's no weird interview thing where you're like pretending to regurgitate a algorithm that you've already memorized or whatever, you know?
Yeah, it's really weird. I feel like, I don't know how that happened, but I feel the big tech kind of regurgitated the whole industrial educational model and just kind of like you're so counterintuitive because you think they would understand that those things are not needed, but maybe there's such a big size and the people in charge for like a lot of the time came from that kind of traditional educational model, and that's how they feel like it should work. But I think more and more people are starting to, or like these companies are starting to realize that this might not be the most optional way to get candidates.
I'll say from the inside, my perspective is we got so many applicants for the job roles, right? Everybody wants to work at Fang, that you needed a way of weeding people out. And so you would just pick, it's a pretty much arbitrary way of weeding people out, right? LeetCode is just like, okay, did they grind LeetCode for a month before they went into this interview? Yes or no. If they did, then they've met whatever bar, made up bar we've come up with to say this person should work here or not, right? It was purely like a fake grounds for weeding people out, pretty much, because you got too many. For every job you posted, you got 10,000 applicants. Those would get weeded down to maybe a couple hundred, and then those would have to get interviewed, right? And so it's like, okay, I got to pick one out of these couple hundred people who want to work here. How else are we going to do it other than this stupid LeetCode thing? I agree, though, it's really stupid.
Yeah, I feel like there's definitely alternatives that from
I wish more people would like opt out of Fang, basically, right?
Yeah,
I think sure. The reason they have all this power is because everybody's like slobbering to get into these companies. And so I'm always telling all my like ex-coworkers who are still working at some Fang, right, usually they would like leave Amazon, go to Facebook or go to Google, or they'd go from Google back to Amazon or whatever, right? And I'm always like, your life is going to be 10 times better if you leave these Fang companies. Because to your point about impact, right? You are affecting a lot of customers when you're making changes in a Fang code base, but it's most of the improvements I was making were like incremental minimal things where it was like, yeah, okay, we need to like reduce the latency of this thing by 10%, or we need to this ML model needs to get like this percent more precise than it was before or whatever, right? So that's going to affect thousands of customers when that model gets better, but it's not like I was launching a new model from scratch or something like that, right? Whereas when you're working at startups, you're constantly building new stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of just being comfortable as well. I feel like a lot of people don't really like to take that kind of risk. And when you're being paid good wages to not have to work that much, and you don't really feel like you're missing anything. Like if you're not ambitious and you want to make millions of dollars, there's not really a single good reason to get out of that position. You don't really need to go through any weird interviews anymore. You already have the track record, you probably have the network to people that working in other Fang companies. So it kind of makes sense that you kind of like this incestuous relationship between all the Fang hires and stuff like that. So yeah, I don't think it's going to change anytime soon.
Until Fang dies, basically, right? It's like if, which I only see it really happening through some regulatory movement, right? Like the government's basically going to have to come. Because all of these Fang companies have such a strong business moat that it's like, which I guess we're going to get into all this stuff. Like, I was glad when you DM'd me, you were like, I want to ask you about investing and not security, because I was like, dude, I'm so sick. I've done like 4 podcast interviews and they're always about security. And I'm like, I made a joke to my wife. It was like, I was like, it's like you find out Warren Buffett drives Uber on the weekend and you get him on a podcast to ask him his techniques about driving Uber or whatever. It's like the vast majority of the money I make is not through security, but it's cooler, right? Like it's way cooler to talk about finding bugs and hacking smart contracts than it is to talk about investing. And so nobody ever wants to ask me any questions about that. But anyway, my point is that these Fang companies have such a strong business moat that I don't see that they are effectively monopolies, right? And so I don't see the way that they're doing things ever changing until the government steps in and changes something associated with it. And the problem is the regulators don't really understand the internet businesses well enough to know how to regulate them, right? They keep trying to push through laws and like break up these companies, and they keep getting ousted by the Supreme Court and stuff like that. It's all getting overturned because the regulators don't really understand it. The old antitrust regulation was written because it was anti-consumer. And the problem with these big tech companies is they're all pro-consumer. And so it's very hard to use the old regulation in order to argue that these things need to change or whatever, because they're all good for consumers.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. But first, I'd like to thank the amazing sponsors of this podcast. Managing on-chain payroll, vesting plans, and airdrops with traditional solutions can quickly become time-consuming and lead to misaligned incentives. Sabler is a battle-tested, free-to-use, open-source solution for token distribution. It's available on Ethereum and nearly every EVM chain out there, and the core protocol is decentralized and permissionless. Organizations like Shapeshift, Maple Finance, and TokenSight have used Sabler to manage vesting plans and grants with hundreds of different recipients. Treasury managers are head over heels for Sabler, thanks to the peace of mind and great user experience. Learn how Sabler can boost your organization and book a demo to get started at sabler.com. Yeah, I think it's a really tricky problem that has really tricky solutions. Like, the change needs to come from a place that has no incentive to want to do it, if that makes sense.
Right.
But don't get too excited, because I do have some auditing related questions.
sure, yeah, I'm happy to answer them.
A lot of people are still really keen to hear about investing, not necessarily the smart contract audit crowd, but just in general. And I think there's definitely ways that being an auditor can be beneficial to you as an investor, and that's essentially what I wanted to ask you about. If you found that being an auditor benefited you in some way or another in relation to investing, either maybe in terms of the way you think, or maybe in terms of being exposed to projects early on and kind of being able to leverage that.
Yeah, so when I first started, that was actually my intent originally. The whole reason I got into auditing was for that reason, exactly that reason, where I was like, oh, I'll get to audit these projects and see like what's going to be the next Uniswap or whatever. And so I'll be able to get in early on it or whatever. I feel like it actually hasn't worked out that way, to be quite honest. I think part of the problem is like the overwhelming majority of the stuff you end up auditing is like derivative work. It's like somebody has taken Aave and jammed it into Convex, and that's a new project. Or they fork Velodrome, or Uniswap, right, is obviously another classic one, and people are always forking, right? And so it's like they're interesting from an investing perspective, right? I mean, you can make money sort of investing in these fork basically before they get even to like tens of millions in TVL or something like that, right? But you're not often going to get the next Uniswap, right, when you're auditing. And in fact, one thing I've learned is, as an investor at least, is that the technology is actually not that important. The meme coins are a good example of this, right? You could have made a boatload of money if you were in early on Doge, or you were in early on Pepe, or any of these other meme coins, and they had no technology. They had no technological advantage whatsoever. I think where you're going to make the most amount of money as an investor is sort of the marriage of those two things. So it's not enough, as an investor, it's not enough for me to do technical due diligence, doing smart contract auditing, to say, okay, I know this code is solid, I know this team takes security seriously. They might just be an engineering focused project, and that project might not go anywhere because they don't know how to actually build a business and do marketing and do sales and all these other things, right? In order to make a successful project, it's more than just writing really good code. What I will say though is it's made me much more cautious in terms of taking on smart contract risk whenever I'm interacting with DeFi protocols. So early on, I was a DeFi degen, right? And I didn't really, I mean, I knew there were smart contracts going on behind the scenes when I was like investing in stuff or like, you know, throwing it into pools and stuff like that. But I didn't quite understand how easy it was to break this stuff. That's actually how I got into the space. I was actually listening to your interview with Riptide. It was the same thing with him, right? You start off doing degenerate stuff in these DeFi protocols, you get hacked or you get wrecked enough times, and you're like, oh shit, like there's a massive need for somebody to like come in and fix this and clean this space up or whatever. And so you end up becoming a smart contract. So in a sense, it was kind of the opposite. I got into smart contracting. I started as an investor, I started as a degen, and then ended up getting into auditing sort of as a side benefit of that. But yeah, I would say like in general, it hasn't really helped me that dramatically. Sure, I'll like before I ape into something, right? I will like look and see if it's been audited, make sure it's been audited, see who's auditing it. I think that's also a benefit, right? Like I can tell the difference between what's the auditing firm that everybody shits on all the time? Certik. I know the difference between Certik and Spearbit or something like that, right? So if I see who's done the audit, then it's like, okay, yeah, I know this is safe or whatever. But it's not necessarily giving me any new alpha where I'm like, I will actually say like summarily, I've never invested in any of the things I've audited.
Yeah, I feel like just having that notion of the security risks. It's really beneficial,
Right.
and you don't need to be an auditor for that. You just have to kind of be on top of the.
You just have to be aware of it. I think one of the big problem is like the people aren't even aware that this is happening. Yeah.
No one factors in the security risk. They all factor in just the market risk, but they forget that people can get hacked really easily. And
And all you have to do is go through that one time and you're like, oh, I never want that to happen again. I think another problem too is like most people are not tossing that much money into these things. But what happens is like if you make string a couple of wins together, you can very quickly accumulate a large amount of capital. And then when you're putting half a million into a DeFi protocol and like trying to get yield on half a million, that's different than doing it with 10K or something like that, right? The smart contract risk of losing half a million is massively different than losing 10 grand. People would shrug their shoulders and go, oh, 10 grand, whatever. But if they lose half a million, they're going to be pissed, right? And so your conception of risk changes as the quantums of capital that you're deploying into these DeFi protocol changes.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, right? For you to be able to deploy that amount of funds to a smart contract, it needs to be secure. But then when it's not secure and you find out that that kind of money doesn't come back, and then the security doesn't kind of get improved that much because people that had a lot of money and lost it are not coming back to kind of reinvest and bring the security up to standard where it should be. And you mentioned that some projects might be really focused on good engineering, but not necessarily marketing and how to run a business. So how do you find a sweet spot where something it's has good fundamentals from a technical perspective, but it's also like good in marketing and knows how to put the word out there?
Yeah, that's the $1 million question. When you find those, one thing I've learned, I think I've been through three bull markets now. This will be, I guess, if you count this one, it'll be my fourth, I think. Yeah,
How old
the
are
one
you?
we're in now.
Jesus.
If you call it a, I've just been from the beginning. I've really been interested in crypto. Like I bought Bitcoin back when it was like 500, so I've been around basically
Oh,
for that
okay,
long.
yeah.
One thing I've learned is, when you do find those, you load up. You buy as much as you can. Like previously, I would be like very risk averse and like, okay, I don't want to like blow up my portfolio. Like, I'll put 10% of it into this thing that I found is like really good. You get a sense after you've had a couple of wins. You get a sense and you can start smelling where the wins are coming from, and you know, okay, like this is a thing that I'm gonna. So part of it is just staying in the market long enough to understand like when you found one of those things. For me, it's primarily like one of the things too from being around that long is you start following other folks who have your sort of nose for investing and finding projects and stuff like that, and they're finding things that you conceptually know how to value. And so they're bringing you alpha. And primarily it's just a matter of me doing a bunch of research and finding out, okay, like I'll go into the team's Discord, right? I'll ask the team's team Discord, right? I think one of the books I sent you when we were chatting in the Twitter thing was Phil Fisher's book, Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits, right? He talks about his how he goes about finding investments in traditional equity. And when I read that book, I realized like how little due diligence I was doing myself when I was deciding on these things. And he goes through and talks about like cold calling the management, cold calling the investor relations, cold calling their competitors to see how the competitors feel about the company, right? All this stuff that is outside of the balance sheet that you're looking at when you're taking on an investment. That I just wasn't doing, right? And after I read that book, I was like, oh, okay, like these are the sorts of things I need to do my due diligence on before I decide I'm going to buy something. So typically the way it will work is like, I just found something like a month ago that I started plowing cash into. And the way it worked is like, somebody I follow, he was like number two on the FTX leaderboard back in the day before FTX imploded. So he's a good trader, right? He started tweeting bullish stuff about this particular project, right? Now, everybody's always trying to pump their bags, right? So it's not sufficient for them to say, hey, I found this new thing, you should check it out or whatever, right? Okay, yeah, cool, it's on my radar or whatever, right? But I have to take all these extra steps that I was just talking about that I learned through these books before I feel comfortable and say, okay, yeah, I'm going to deploy a bunch of capital to this thing, right? So I go through, I read their white papers, I read all their documentation, I play around with the project, right? I get a feel for like, what is the thing? How does it work? How do they make money, right? All this stuff. In this particular case, they're doing a buyback and burn. So you're asking about like, how do I know these people are business savvy or whatever? A lot of it is like returning capital back to the shareholders. And the way that you do that in crypto markets is doing buybacks and burns, right? So basically, you could think of it as like a share buyback in traditional equity or whatever, right? So then I go and do an investigation of that and I see like, is this company actually doing the buyback and burn? I could see it on chain, right? This is one of the benefits from traditional equity to cryptocurrency, for example, right? Everything's on chain. So I can go sleuth the chain and figure out like, okay, who are they interact with? Who's playing with the smart contract? How much volume are they getting, right? All this stuff you can go do an analysis of. So that's sort of the process before I finally say, okay, like, yes, this thing is valuable and I'm going to put money into it. Well, you also do like a comparison of like, okay, there are other projects in the space that are similar to this one, right? Like a good example is like Uniswap, right? Uniswap's the OG of like DEXs, right? And so you can say, okay, Uniswap's market cap for their governance token is whatever it is, I don't know what it is, right? 2 billion or something, right? So you can sort of say, okay, they've got this much volume. I found another DEX token that's got 10% of that or something, but the token is actually trading at 1% the value of Uniswap. So you do sort of like a relative thing in your head where it's like, okay, this thing probably should be worth like a little bit more than it is now. That might be sufficient justification to say, okay, I should buy this. And then it also gives you an exit point where you're like, okay, I think it could probably, you know, reasonably double from here based on this other analysis. I'll buy it and then get out of it when it doubles or something like that. I'm not holding any DEX tokens, but just an example of another thing I might do in my head.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of moving parts that are, you just kind of have to develop through experience. For example, first you have to be able to identify things that could be a good opportunity. Then you have to learn how to actually evaluate if those opportunities are worth it, and then you kind of have to know how to follow through and stay on top of things. So with those high level three things in mind, can you give us an overview how that looks like from your end?
Yeah, like I was saying, the first step, sort of, if you look at it as a funnel, right? Because so what it, like, I'm following probably 10 traders that I've sort of like accumulated over, they're almost like Pokemon cards on my Twitter feed, right? Over the years, as I've traded, right, I've been like, okay, this person knows what they're talking about, this person has no idea. Like, as soon as I find out somebody tweets something and I know is bullshit or it's wrong or whatever, I'll get them off my Twitter feed like immediately. I'm very focused on curating my Twitter feed, right, to only follow people who are like really bringing me good alpha that I know I can go investigate, right? And so there might be like 50 things that come in through there, right? And then of those 50, I need to whittle it down again. And I'll do that through all the things I was telling you, right? I'll hop into their Discord. I'll ask the founders questions about how they're thinking about things. I'll do a bunch of on-chain analysis. I'll read their white papers, right? All this stuff, right? Everything that's out there about each of these 50 projects, I'll read everything I possibly can on those 50 projects. And then that'll whittle it down to like maybe five. And then of those five, I'll sort of pick the one that I think has the highest probability of doing the best. And usually I'm not holding that much stuff, right? That's another thing I learned through, I think I might have, I didn't, maybe I didn't send you Poor Charlie's Almanac is Charlie Munger is Warren Buffett's side man, his right-hand man. And he has this, he calls it diversification, right? His idea is like you shouldn't be diversifying, right? There's another fallacy I think a lot of folks have when they're getting into investing is they think that they need to spread their capital across many different opportunities. I don't do that. Like of those 50 that I are on my radar, I'll pick like one or two of them and I'll absolutely load up on them because if I, it also forces me to like make sure I'm doing the research right because I have to have high conviction on the things that I'm picking. So anyway, that's sort of like from top. From like this thing's on my radar to, okay, I'm buying this thing. That's sort of what it looks like.
Yeah, that's cool. And how similar or different would you say that is between crypto investments and traditional stocks?
Yeah, crypto is like, it's harder. It's both harder and easier at the same time. Because in crypto, you do have all this data that you don't necessarily get in traditional equity markets. Like being able to check the chain, I think is like totally invaluable, and I don't think enough people are like really doing that sort of analysis before they pick stuff. But the drawback of crypto is like there you can easily get rug pulled, right? It's like everybody thought FTX was safe. FTX is a great example, right? So people were putting money into it because they were out there saying all this shit on Twitter about how safe they are and everything like that. And you could, I mean, again, it sort of speaks to being able to check the chain, right? This is another reason. Like, I don't use centralized exchanges. Basically, I use centralized exchanges to go from fiat into crypto, and they're just like a little in-between spot. I'm like primarily doing everything on chain for that reason, right? I've learned enough times, I've been rug pulled enough times on centralized exchanges. They've done things like block my accounts or stop me from withdrawing or whatever, or even FTX is a good example, right? You lose all your money. So the benefits of crypto are that you've got this sort of transparency and you can check everything and you can read white papers and you can ask the founders questions directly about how they're thinking about things and all that stuff. But there's a like a high amount of fraud, right? And so you have to be worried about that like constantly. And then also the smart contract risk, right? You have to be worried about like, is my money just going to get evaporated tomorrow, whatever, right? Whereas like if you're investing in traditional equities in like a brokerage account, that money isn't just going to disappear. There was like this big scare about like, regional banks going under recently or whatever. They all have FDIC insurance, right? The government's going to backstop the banks. There aren't going to be any bank runs, right? That's the only way you could conceivably lose all your money. Whereas crypto, right? So your cash is safe and how you're doing and stuff. The other thing is that presumably, hopefully, right? The equity, they're issuing. They're doing earnings calls every quarter and issuing 10-Ks every quarter, right? And so you can see the money going in and out of the business. You're getting a lot more. There's a lot more data around like how is this thing performing as an actual business, right? So in that regard, I view equities much safer because I'm able to reason a lot better about the potentials of the business and how the business is operating based on different ratios and stuff like that I'm not going to get. In crypto land. So in that regard, crypto is more like a casino when I'm trying to assess risk in that perspective, and equities are much safer in that regard.
So, what's the split for you between crypto and traditional investments?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends, depending on like what the markets are doing. Kind of like if crypto is up, right? Like if crypto's like I saw somebody the other day was like saying Warren Buffett's stake in Apple is like 40% or something like that, and they were saying like using that to say like he's super bullish on Apple or whatever, but it was like no, he bought Apple back when it was trading at a PE of like 12 or something, and now it's trading at a PE of 30, and it just happens to like be a massive part of his portfolio because it's grown so much since he hasn't been putting more cash into Apple, right? If he was doing that would be a bullish sign, but he's not doing that. So it's kind of the same with me, right? It's like it really just depends on like, because I'll let things ride, right? If the crypto market, like recently, right, when it was going ballistic, it was probably like 30, 40% of my portfolio or something like that. And then, as crypto market goes down, it's lesser. So, but probably your question is like, okay, right now, what's it at right now? I think right now it's probably 10 to 20% crypto, and then the rest is in equities or cash. Equities or cash, but 10 to 20% in crypto.
And how much time do you allocate to managing all those investments? Is it something that you deliberately allocate time to? Is it something that you're just constantly doing as like a daily thing? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I mean, the thing of it is like I'm obsessed with it, right? All those books I sent you, right? I like, this is something I don't think I'm as obsessed with. Well, probably this and programming, right? Programming and finance are the two things that I'm like absolutely obsessed with. I could spend 24 hours a day doing nothing but this. And so, yeah, I do. I'm like constantly on top of the markets. I spend more time thinking about equities than I do crypto. It just happens that like because I'm in the crypto space, I'm working in the crypto space, I tend to get some alpha coming into me from crypto, and I can sort of like use that alpha. But yeah, I'm like 24/7, like always when I'm not heads down coding or whatever, doing things for work or auditing or whatever, I'm constantly thinking about markets pretty much.
So how much
Now,
time do
that doesn't necessarily mean I'm like trading in and out of stuff, right? I very much am like a buy and hold guy. Like when I found something and I have conviction on that thing, I will buy it and I will keep buying it with all the cash that I have until I'm out of cash. And then when I get new cash, I keep buying that thing or whatever, right? So I'm not watching charts. I think people get the impression that I'm like a day trader or something like that. I'm not, right? I'm not going like, oh, we've hit this resistance level, I gotta sell out of this thing or whatever, right? I'm purely looking at fundamentals and going, this is a fantastic business. I want to own shares in this business.
Yeah, I think there's a difference that's important to make of being a day trader and just being from a more like a fundamental perspective. It's an entirely different type of research that you're doing in your kind of lifestyle in general. It's an rules entirely different kind of
I
things that
find it
you
less
actually.
stressful, right? Because I'm not like constantly checking charts and going, oh, I shouldn't have taken margin or whatever, right? Like one of the things I think I told you this in our Twitter DMs, right? I think one of my biggest advantages is my psychological composure. I'm very much like, once I've made the decision and I've done enough of the research, I'm confident enough in my research and my decision making that I just let things go the way they go. And I just say, okay, I made this decision, now I have to live with it. And I might lag the market some years, I might beat the market some years, but it is what it is, and I just need to. And often it's like, okay, other things will outperform my choices, but I don't panic and go, oh, I made the wrong choice, I need to sell out of this thing and go into this thing, right? I'm very composed about all this stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how much time you think people should allocate if they want to be successful investors and beat the market? Because obviously it's not something easy to do and you need to put in the time somehow. So, and that's, I feel like, a place where a lot of people fall short. They kind of underestimate how much research and commitment it takes to be successful in that area. So if you had to draw a line somewhere for someone that maybe was starting now and they wanna get good at it, and like maybe from two different perspectives, from how much time to get good at it, and also once you're good at it, what is the maintenance cost of keeping up that level of performance?
Yeah, you know what's interesting about it? Like, I didn't realize it until just now while we're having this conversation, that it is a little bit like an art form insofar as like your prior learnings will compound into the future and make you better. It's like anything, right? You do things enough times. It's the 10 years rule, right? Where it's like you master something after doing it for 10 years or 10,000 hours or whatever, right? This actually, I think, does apply to investing as well, right? If you do enough of this, you've seen, like I was telling you before, right? I've seen three or four bull markets now where I know when I see something, I know this is something, right? Because I've done it enough times. I've lost money enough times. I've missed the boat enough times. I've got my ass kicked enough times and I've won enough times to sort of be able to reason about the two and like figure out, okay, this is a winner and this is a loser. So it's hard to answer, right? Because it is like I can crank out probably 70% more code now after having programmed for a decade than I could when I started. And the code is of much higher quality than it was then, right? So I can spend less time and get the same output as a consequence of that, right? I feel like the same thing probably applies to investing, where it's like, okay, I probably spend much less time about, you know, doing all this stuff because I've got locked in kind of how I reason about this stuff. So I don't need to spend as much time as I was back then. But when I was first learning this stuff, I only worked at Amazon. I wasn't also doing smart contract auditing or anything like that, right? And so I was basically working like a 9-to-5 at Amazon. And then the rest of my day was spent reading and researching and investing and making financial decisions. And so what that would put it at like maybe 4 hours a day during the weekday. And then the entirety of my weekends, probably 10 hours or whatever, right? So maybe it was basically, yeah, I guess at that point, basically a full-time job for those 2 or 3 years while I was doing this at Amazon. I would say you were kind of treating it as like a full-time job at that point. Unless you're willing to do basically work a full-time job outside of whatever you're doing to figure this out and like, you know, really get it honed in, I would highly recommend just indexing. Is there even years where I lag the market? Like last year was a bear market and I lagged the market last year. That's another reason why this is really hard, because you constantly second guessing yourself and going like, am I making the right decisions or not? Because constantly in my head, what I'm doing is I'm going, what is the opportunity cost of just setting this as an index fund and forgetting about it? And unless I can beat that, then I should just hang it up and not do anything, right? And so you will have years where you're going to underperform, and it's going to really crush your psyche a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like that's something I really want to get into in just a moment. But before we get into that, why should anyone be listening to you about all this advice you're giving? Like, well, what the hell do you do? Why is your advice meaningful and should be taken into account?
Are you letting me toot my own horn now? Because I already told you what my returns were. I like how you did that due diligence up front, so you knew when you asked this question that I'd be able to give a valid answer. Yeah, so I guess, yeah, we didn't even start with an intro of like, who am I? Like,
yeah, maybe we can do that as well. I'll just put this in the start of the podcast.
We were talking, I guess probably you'd started the recording, so you got your degree in music. I also got a degree in music. I started my life as a musician. Eventually, I taught myself how to code while I was touring. I went back, got my degree in computer science. After I got my degree in computer science, I went and worked at Amazon. And in the context of what we're talking about here, what happened was I was making a bunch of money at Amazon. And I didn't, like, I'd sort of been taught the traditional wisdom of investing, which is like 60-40 stock bond split or buy a target date fund or all this other stuff. And so all throughout my life, prior to like making money at Amazon, I was doing that traditional things that you learn to do. I think one of the first books I read was actually the book I recommended to you, which was The Little Book of Common Sense Investing. It's written by Jack Bogle, who's the founder of the index fund, right? And he goes through all the math about like how it's basically nearly impossible to beat the market and how everybody basically should just be doing an index. Warren Buffett famously had a bet with a famous hedge fund manager where he said, like, after 10 years, you can pick any hedge fund you want, and I'm going to pick an index fund. And after 10 years, if mine beats yours, then you have to donate $1 million to charity or something like this. You can look all this up and see, like, okay, yeah, the index fund just crushes, basically, most of the time. And so I sort of was doing that. I was doing index fund investing and just going, I can't beat the market. I'm not even going to try. But then I started reading a bunch of these books, which I think we're probably going to add a lot of these books in the show notes. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
So we'll talk about all the books that I've read over the years as I was like learning how to do investing. And so eventually I was like, okay, I was taking small parts of my the money I was originally putting into index funds, and I was like trying to slowly figure out how to do this myself. And the money was small enough that like it wasn't psychologically affecting me when I was making wrong decisions. So I know that one of the books in that book list is Thinking Fast and Slow. It's Daniel Kahneman. He's like a famous like risk psychologist researcher, basically. He's the book is basically about how people make decisions under circumstances that are stressful or that involve risk or something like this, right? And he's done a bunch of research to show that like people don't actually make optimal economic decisions. They can be nodded and nudged in certain directions, and they make phallic decisions when they are under duress and stuff like this, right? So that was one of the books I realized. I was like, oh, psychology is like very much important to this, right? And that doesn't come into play until you're putting at stake a large amount of money, or large is relative to everybody, right? But what you would think is a large amount of money, that's when you start, your body starts getting stressed out and you start losing sleep and all this stuff, right? So I was playing with, you know, small amounts of money, and then I started to get the hang of it. I started to figure out how to do this stuff. And then I slowly started, okay, I can actually beat the market. I have data to suggest that I can beat the market. And I started taking this index fund money and like investing it in actual companies. One of the things he asked me before we got on the call was what my kind of rate of return has been. And it's been, the last time I calculated, it was around 27% compounded annually. So I can beat the market. And so I guess, I mean, there's always a question of like, you know, is this guy charlatan? I could tell you whatever I want and tell you I could beat the market or whatever. But it is what it is. You can believe me or not believe me. I guess that I know what I'm talking about.
yeah, that's fair enough. And over, what's the period of time from that return that you just gave us? Like, how many years?
Yeah, about 5 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 5 years. I've been managing my own money and managed to get that return. Now, like I said, last year was actually the first year I lagged the market. So there are some years where I don't, but if you compound it over a long, long time, that five-year time horizon, it ends up being around 27%.
Yeah, cool. And you just mentioned a lot about being stressed over investing too much and losing sleep and all that sort of stuff. So what are some of the psychological challenges and tactics you use to deal with that? And what sort of user approach to keep sane while treading all these dangerous waters?
Yeah, I think in that regard, I am, like I said, I think that's one of my unique advantages as an investor, is I really have a stomach of steel, and I don't even think about it, quite honestly. So when I was doing the music thing, I took a detour, I guess, and I got really into Buddhism. And the whole point of Buddhism is like, everything is impermanent, like nothing lasts forever, things will crumble, societies will end. There's a sort of a nihilistic aspect to Buddhism, right? And then there's also this aspect of like introspection, where you're sort of like analyzing your emotions as they're coming in, and you're learning to deal with them and sort of reason about them dispassionately, right? This was all before I got into finance or even into programming. I've been deep into Buddhism. But I think that philosophy has sort of helped me like not really care about it. It gets to a point financially where it's really more like a game. Like, I've had friends of my wife like go out to dinner and be like, dude, do you need any more money? Like, you know, like, just slow it down. It's not, people think because I'm interested in the art of investing that I'm also like obsessed with money, right? And that actually isn't the case. It's like the way I told her, I said it's a hobby for me. It's like fishing or something like that, right? I go out and tell people, or her husband golfs, right? And so he might tell his wife about, you know, the great hole of golf that he played, how he golfed par on a particularly hard round or something like that, right? That's sort of the way I view it, is like, I don't actually take it that seriously. You might think like, okay, well, why don't you just do like paper trading or whatever, or mock trading or whatever. They have these ways of like, you can sort of do trading without actually putting your money at stake. But I think one aspect of the art of investing is the psychology, right? That was one of the things I learned reading Daniel Kahneman's book, is that that is actually part of the game, is being able to manage your psychology and having actual money at stake. It's like when you go play poker with somebody and you're playing with like fake chips or whatever, right? You play a very different game of poker when you're not stressed out about the money that you're potentially losing or winning, right? It's very much the same way in markets for me. So that's part of the game, and that's part of the reason why money is actually has to be put up at stake or whatever. But I don't really let it like affect me, right? Like if I'm losing hundreds of thousands or making hundreds of thousands, it does. It, at some point, like SBF sort of, I think, said something similar where it was like, it's just kind of like a video game, right? At that point, you're trying to accumulate points in World of Warcraft or something like this. At some point, it really is like, okay, I don't really need this anymore. Now it's just more about, I like doing this analysis. I like doing the research. I like, so I think for that reason, it makes you able to be like, okay, whatever. It is what it is. And like I said, part of it is like, I have to accept the decisions I've made and say, it is what it is. Like, I've made the decision. Now I have to accept whatever returns are going to come from that decision.
I love that you quoted SBF.
I highly recommend that book. The book is really good. The Daniel Kahneman book, right? I highly, highly recommend it. I think when I sent it to you, I told you. After I read that, I realized I was going to be rich. Because I was like, it was almost like I'd unlocked this different perspective of like, I think one of the examples he talks about is like, somebody, there's two people, or the same person has to make a decision where he has to sell an asset that's gone up in value or sell an asset that's gone down in value. And the logical thing to do is actually to sell the asset that's gone down in value, because he wouldn't have to pay the taxes on it. And then he can reallocate that to a winner or something like that. But psychologically, you don't want to accept defeat and say, oh, I made a wrong decision here. And so I lost money. And so what people end up doing is sell the winner instead, even though it doesn't make any logical sense, right? So I basically just look at it as like a probability distribution and a bet that I'm making up on like a probability distribution or something like that, right? And so when the market is like going volatile and it's down or whatever, unless there's like a really fundamental reason for it to be going down, like the business is about to go bankrupt, or the management has done something really bad, or they had a really bad earnings call, or they're giving really bad guidance or something like this, right? Like unless there's a reason for the stock price to go down, it doesn't even register to me. It's like just noise, right? I just go, okay, that's noise, and I move on. That's, I guess, part of the art of it is like knowing when a piece of information is important and when it's something that can be ignored, right? And you're only going to get that as you do it over a long enough time period.
Yeah. Would you say that it started out as being financially motivated, and then as you got good at it and kind of surpassed the financial target that you had, it became more of a matter of continuing to play this game that you became good at? You know, if you take someone that's been working really hard for years on end, and you, for example, billionaires, I think it's a good example here. Billionaires could have stopped working a long, long time ago before they started becoming billionaires, but most billionaires work even harder once they reach that level. So do you feel like it's something that in that same kind of area?
Yeah, I do. In fact, like, yeah, initially it was purely about financial independence and being able to, like, what it did is it brought me less stress in my job, because I was like, once you hit a certain financial milestone that you've deemed as like financial independence, and everybody's different, everybody has a different number, but once you hit that number, the freedom of like, at least for me, I found that I was a much better employee and a much better programmer, because I wasn't stressed out constantly about, like, I didn't have this mindset of like, oh, if they fire me, it's all over for me, and like that's going to be the end of it or whatever, right? And so I was able to like push back on shitty managers and tell them why they were wrong, or, you know, I was less of a pushover, because once I'd achieved that financial independence, I was able to be like, okay, I have fuck you money. If you don't like what I'm telling you, then I'll just leave and go somewhere else or whatever, right? So it was purely, initially, that was purely the only reason why I did it. And you're right, at some point it morphs into, like I said, it's more like going fishing or something, or collecting. I've often heard like some of the best investors when they were kids started out as like avid collectors. That wasn't the case with me, but I think that sort of translates, where you're like trying to find the shiniest gem. And you want to like own shares in the gem, right? You want to have ownership in the shiniest gem or whatever, right? It does become a bit like that at some point. It's just, and it's also fun, right? It's very interesting. Like, I'm talking to you on a podcast about it, right? It's an interesting, very interesting topic, at least to me.
Yeah,
I know to a lot of people it's not, right? Like even my brother, for example, he does not want to talk about balance sheets. He doesn't want to talk about discounted cash flows. He doesn't want to talk about the next earnings call for Microsoft or whatever, right? And those people, it's great, right? I give them the little book of common sense investing. They understand the math behind index investing and they go do an index fund. And there's nothing wrong with that.
I know, fair enough. Like you said, if you're not willing to put in the amount of time that is necessary to be successful in that kind of area, you might as well not doing it at all, because you might just shoot yourself in the
It's
foot.
not just time, it's also the stress, like we were talking about, right? Like for some people to make some of the bets that I make with the number of dollars that I put behind a bet, it would keep them up at night and they wouldn't be able to sleep. And they would be like, when their investment went down by 20%, they would be like mad at their spouse or whatever, right? Like it's not a happy way of living if you can't psychologically handle and deal with the ramifications of that, right? Whereas an index fund, it's less stressful because you can just say the market will give me what it gives me, and there's nothing I can do about it. I'm just going to accept it.
Yeah, and how long did it take until you were at a position that you kind of started building some confidence and started to feel like you knew what you're doing and could listen to your gut in a way?
It's like I told you in our DMs, right? Like that never goes away. I feel like if you're overconfident in any particular investment or even in your skills, then you're doing it wrong. Like you basically constantly have to be paranoid and second guessing your investment thesis and figuring out ways of checking your investment thesis and making sure that your investment thesis is still valid. So you're never going to feel like, okay, I'm a genius at this and I'm like the best at it and there's no not going to be anyone better than me at it or whatever, right? I'm always learning as a I think that's part of it is like you're constantly learning as a consequence of like you make a bad investment and you sit down and realize, think, okay, what went wrong here? How did I get this wrong? Did I pay too much for this asset? Was it overpriced? Was there some bit of research that I missed that I can add next time and do that as well, right? It's like very similar. I guess you were asking about smart contract auditing, right? Auditing is very much the same thing, right? It's very similar to smart contract auditing, which I think is also an art, right? These are both just two different art forms that it's like you have to view it from a lifetime of practicing the art and not just like, how do I get rich quickly?
I think it's an interesting comparison to make. I forgot what I was gonna ask you. You talk too much.
Sorry. That's good for a podcast, right? You want your guests to ramble.
Not too much, because then I have to edit this, and then I'm like, and you're speaking, I'm like, oh. And I'm thinking, like, I'm gonna say this, and then you say some more shit. I was like, oh no, now I can say this. And then now I'm just like, I don't remember anything I was gonna say anymore.
Sorry, dude. I'll try to keep my answers more
I'm just joking,
precise.
man. You go off, give your rants. There's no hard lines here.
Yeah, what were we talking about?
Don't
That
know
would have been a
anymore.
good, some other question about, oh, you're asking about like, when did I feel confident? When did I start feeling confident?
Oh no, I remember what I wanted to ask you. Is that how does that process look like when you're reevaluating your thesis, and maybe even when you're from the process of creating one and then reevaluating constantly? How does that look like in your head and on a daily basis?
I'll give you a good example. So I like towards the end of the 20, I think this would have been the 2017 bull run, it became clear to me like, okay, like we've hit the top, like it's time to get out. And I didn't time it nearly as good during the 2017 bull run as I did during the what it would be the 2020 or whenever that last the last bull run ended. That one I managed to get out of the top, and because I'd seen enough that I was like, okay, this is getting too crazy. Like people started calling me a pussy on my Twitter. Like that's when you're like, okay, I'm making the right decision. So I got out towards I was probably like right in the midway, basically at the end of the last or the 2017 bull run. And This was around the time Buffett started accumulating his Apple stake. And I was still trying to get a handle on, like, okay, am I confident enough in my skills to like take all this money out of an index fund and like start managing it myself? And so part of my learning was basically like I would watch some of the other great investors that are still doing it and see take their action, watch them take the action and try and replicate it, right? Reverse engineer their thought process for like how did they get to this decision that now is the time to buy Apple stock or whatever. And so I tried to get in Buffett's head at that point and figure out, okay, why does he? I think part of it was like they were just starting to do like this the monstrous buybacks. They were also making the transition from a services a hardware business, like a products business, into a services business. So that sort of tends to change the multiple as well. And so I think a couple of these things sort of coalesced together at that time period. And also they were trading cheaply. It was like I said, Buffett started accumulating it at 12. I think I got it around 14 or 15 was the BE when I started accumulating my app. So I took all my crypto, put it into Apple, basically. And mostly it's just a matter of conviction. You go, okay, Apple's a fantastic business. Like I don't need to do anything else. I just bought, you buy the shares and you ignore it and go, okay, this happened and now I'm done look even thinking about it, right?
But at
But
one point, you can stop being a tremendous business, right?
exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah. So at some point, you have to reassess the thesis and go, is this still a valid thesis? The thesis that I used to buy the shares back then, do I still believe this or not? Right. You bring up a great point, right? It's like every dollar. I just had this conversation with a lot of my coworkers at Robinhood, right? Robinhood just had their earnings call last Thursday or something like that. It wasn't great. The stock was down 20% or something like that after the earnings call, right? And so we're all talking about it amongst ourselves, like how do we see the future of the business? Should we sell our shares? Blah 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 blah, right? And I was telling my coworkers that I was like, you can fall into the fallacy of like because I work at this company and they've granted me these shares, by not taking any action, you're also taking an action, right? You're also implicitly saying, I still think Robinhood is a great business and I still want to own these shares every day that you choose not to sell the shares, right? So you need every day is a new day where you have to pause and go and reflect and go, does this still make sense, right? Is this still about the thesis that I had when I was granted these Robinhood shares? Is this still a valid thesis and should I still continue to hold the shares? Even though the stock price has gone down, right? That's where the conviction comes from, right? You have to make the decision. It's like, just because the stock price has gone down, has anything fundamentally changed about the business such that I need to sell the shares and move them into something where I think they're going to grow or whatever, right? So Apple is a good example. Their last earnings call, they missed some growth numbers on, like, I think Apple iPhone revenue was down or something like that, right? And so I have to pause and reflect and go, like, okay, does this still make sense as an investment, right? For me, I didn't view Apple as a growth story. And so some of the market participants got out of the stock because it wasn't growing as quickly. I didn't view it that way when I bought the shares. I never cared really about the growth of iPhone sales or whatever, right? This never bothered me. And so I reassessed at that moment and said, yeah, it still makes sense for me to continue to hold the shares. And so I continue to hold the shares. So all basically everything I'm holding, I'm constantly sort of, as things are happening in the market, as I'm getting new information about a business, I'm reassessing and going, does it still make sense? And is there something else that's piqued my interest that I've seen that I've done my due diligence on that might be better than what I have now? If so, then I should sell these and move that over here.
I think that all makes sense, and is you have to always be, nothing is static. The world is moving all the time, so it's only natural that you have to keep watch of whatever's going on if you actually want to remain relevant and
The
keep
things
your.
that you want to own, though, are the things that, at least the way I do it, are things that you presumably could own forever. And so we were just talking about in this call the FANG companies, right? And how they're effectively monopolies. And the problem is the regulators don't know how to regulate these companies. So I think they're great investments. Like whether however I feel about them as an opinion is sort of unrelated to me, right? I totally toss that out the window and go, I don't care. I shouldn't let how I feel, my conception or how I, if I like a company or not, doesn't matter. I look at the books, and if it's a monopoly and they have massive margins and they're buying back an insane amount of shares, it's a no-brainer, and you go, okay, I want to own this business until something else changes. If a regulator manages to break up one of these big tech companies, that might be something that I would have to revisit my thesis and get out. But until that happens, you want to own a monopoly, because I think you can basically own a monopoly in perpetuity. Now, they would argue they're not monopolies, of course, right? But
yeah, but that's a very narrow case, right? For example, if you are investing in new crypto protocols, then your approach would be very, very different.
Right. Yeah.
So the time frame, I feel like the time frame from reevaluating your strategy
changes.
Changes a lot. So for crypto, something that you might have to reevaluate every 5 years in traditional markets, in crypto might be like 5 weeks.
Crypto, yeah. So my equity strategy is buy and hold forever. So that's how I'm looking at things, and that's how I'm trying to assess things. Crypto is the polar opposite. I will trade crypto because I'm like, this is all speculation, in my opinion. You'll find great cryptocurrency projects that have great fundamentals that don't go anywhere. The market doesn't value them at all in crypto markets. Some of the traders I follow basically call it narrative, right? You're basically looking for what is the next narrative in the next bull run, and you want to get in early and dump it on the people that show up. And it sucks. That is how the markets act in crypto, though. And rather than me, my first bull run, I didn't do that because I was trying to take my equities learning and apply it to cryptocurrency. And so I was buying these things that weren't really going ballistic. And then as I sort of changed my thought process around the cryptocurrency markets, and I realized it is primarily driven by narratives. Then it forces your strategy to change when you're dealing with crypto.
Yeah, I think it'd be really cool if you could. We could leave it in the description all these people that you sort of collected, all these traders that you collected. We could leave their handles in the description. I think that could be really good for people to have a good idea of like good signals that they should pick up on.
Yep. And I'll probably even add like what investments they've brought me in the past to sort of give them a little bit of credibility. Because it's like, if I just say, oh, follow these guys, right? It's a little different than if I'm like, I got in on this thing at this price target because of this person. That it sort of gives their words more credence, I guess.
Yeah, in addition to whatever we're going to leave in the description, do you want to give maybe 2 cents now? On some
2 sentences?
Yeah, just give you a little example for one of those guys that you follow.
Yeah, a good one. A good one's All God Trading. He's the one that I was talking about with the narratives. We can leave his handle in the description, but one of the ones he was early on was GMX, and I was early on GMX with him as a consequence of him sending that.
How do you think they could leverage their position to position themselves better on the market besides the obvious security kind of assessment advantage?
Yeah, I like I said at the beginning, I actually don't think that. I'm like sort of, I think I'm strange in that regard because I'm an engineer who actually doesn't think software is that valuable. Like most of us think code is the best, and like because we're somewhat biased in that regard, right? But I view, when I put my investor hat on, I take my programmer hat off in that regard, where I go, if I look at this from like a business owner perspective, as a CEO or something like that, right? Is the company's tech really that big of a difference? And sometimes it is, right? Sometimes the software really is that much better. So this is actually one thing I was going to say when you were asking about, can you take that same mental model and apply it to crypto in terms of like find a monopoly and exploit the monopoly or whatever? I do think there are some projects that, so we were talking about forking or something like that, I think at the beginning of this call, and how basically software is not that valuable. Oh, yeah, you're saying anybody can show up and deploy to the blockchain, right? And so for that reason, I think that that's why I don't think code is actually that valuable on the blockchain. Because anybody can show up, they can fork your project, they can deploy the same thing that you've got or whatever, right? So the thing that's actually valuable in crypto, or in DeFi at least, is liquidity. And this is why you see projects like Curve and Convex and all this stuff, right? Where they've got these sort of governance tokens where you can direct liquidity to your project or something like this, right? Because liquidity is actually the thing that actually matters. So if you put that sort of, if you have that sort of lens, and you sort of view it from that perspective, right, then you can start to pick out things, right? Where it's like, Uniswap is a good example, right? They basically have a monopoly on liquidity right now. And people are trying to fight with them and take some of the liquidity away. But the problem with liquidity is once it's there, it's like a self-fulfilling cycle, right? All the liquidity is on Uniswap, so the trade executions are better. So that means there's going to be more execution on, Uniswap, which brings more liquidity, and it just, that cycle just keeps building on itself, right? So even though like there's a bunch of things to hate about Uniswap, like, you know, it's not as cap, at least V2, right, wasn't as capital efficient, and that's why Curve exists or whatever, right? Still though, they've got this stranglehold on liquidity, right? So you can still find these like technological advantages that are sort of unrelated to the code. So yeah, I know I didn't answer your question, but I fundamentally don't think that smart contract auditors really have that big of an in as they might think that they do, because everything's on chain, right? So if I want to go look and see who's got the most volume and liquidity, I can go bring up DeFi Llama and check the dashboards and go, ThorChain's crushing it the last month. They've got 10x more volume than they had last month or whatever, right? You don't need to know how ThorChain's protocol works. Again, sure, I'm going to still check that they've done an audit and who the auditor is. And so I think that might be your only advantage as an auditor, is you know who the good auditors are and you can see if they've audited the project or not, right? But aside from that, like using your audits that you're doing, like I said, I haven't bought a single project that I've audited, and I've audited like 30 of them now or something like
that. By the time the project has liquidity, then you don't have that much upside. So how do you figure out like when a project's set up in a way that it's about to get a lot of liquidity, and how do you front run this liquidity?
Now, okay, so I'd actually don't. I'm saying hypothetically, I think if you want to just take the same approach of like buying a monopoly and applying it to crypto, then Uniswap is a good example of that, right? I don't actually follow that strategy myself, right? But I think you have to, if you're gonna do that, and even in traditional equity markets, if you're gonna buy a monopoly, there's gonna be a very limited amount of upside. Right, I almost view my equity portfolio when we're talking about buying a monopoly, very similar to indexing. It's just indexing without the diversification. And I was telling you my theory on diversification. I don't agree with it, right? And so I just go, okay, there's going to be some fixed amount of upside with buying this monopoly, but I know that my money is safe sitting in Apple stock. I know that Apple is going to continue crushing it. They've got a massive cash pile. They're continually buying back shares. That's all I need to know, right? Now I'm not going to get a 10x on Apple, but I'm okay with that. I'm willing to accept that, right? I think the same thing applies to if you're going to do something like Uniswap. You're going to have to say, fine, I'm willing to take capped upside and just do that. You are going to have to get, you're going to have to speculate. You're not going to be able to front run, right? If you really want to try and get a 10x on shit coins, you're going to have to say, I believe in this project. I believe in this team. They're executing very well. Here's my thesis for how I think they're going to grow their business, and it's going to continue growing. But at the end of the day, you're just speculating.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, man, it's been a pleasure having you here. I feel like this was a very different kind of talk. I hope
thanks.
People enjoy it, even though it's a very different kind of subject. And if not, we're going to find out soon enough.
Yeah. Next time you'll have me on, we'll only talk about smart contract auditing, I promise.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for showing up.